Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Forever Island by Patrick D. Smith. Narrated by Jim Siebert.
1. Charlie Jumper stopped the dugout canoe in a pool of black water and watched the fish as it came out of a clump of pickerel weed. He picked up the spear and waited as the gar swam closer, its long snout poking into the decayed matter beneath it. It moved in a slow circle, coming nearer and nearer, until finally the old man smashed the spear into the side of the fish. He flicked the gar into the bottom of the dugout, put down the spear, and pulled the canoe to the next clump of weeds. He muttered,
"Must have two gar. Little George might be hungry today."
High overhead, a flight of crows cawed noisily as they winged their way eastward across the swamp. The old man stood rigidly erect, squinting into the still water. Then, again, the spear slammed downward and a gar was brought into the dugout, its blood spilling over the bottom of the cypress canoe. Once again, the old man pulled the dugout swiftly across the water, causing little waves to form behind and making rippling sounds as they spread outward into the cypress knees. He was moving deeper into the swamp, and the growths of live oaks, dwarf cypress, and cabbage palms, heavily laced with vines, blocked out the sun and caused the stream and the woods to be bathed in a soft yellowish tint. Ahead of him, the white heron lifted itself from the water's edge and glided away from his path, and the gullinule and rail scurried away into the grass. The narrow stream turned and widened out with no visible bank, and at this point the old man turned right, entering an area of dwarf cypress and slimy water. The watermark on the cypress indicated that there was normally 2 feet of water, but now the water was down to 8 inches. The trunks of the trees were dotted with air plants, and scattered throughout the area were clumps of buttonbush and pickerel weed. The old man traveled for 1/2 mile across the green water and then turned into a slough covered with water lilies. This led to a pond of about 2 acres, most of the pond leading again into the dense swamp, but the south portion covered by a mud bank. The dugout glided to within 30 feet of the mud bank and then stopped. Lying atop the bank was a giant alligator, at least 18 feet in length, its body partially sunk into the muck. Aside from its size, it was different from any other alligator because of a scar that ran across the back of its head. Where its right eye had once been, there was now a grotesque clump of scar tissue. The old man and the alligator faced each other, the two eyes locking into the one eye as if in a greeting. Then the man said,
"You will eat now, little George. I have brought you 2 nice garfish.
When the man threw one of the fish from the dugout, the alligator slid from the mud bank and came forward, his tail pushing him through the water. The fish made one brief chomp for his massive jaws, then the second garfish was thrown to him. When he finished this one, he hesitated for a moment, waiting to see if more fish would come from the dugout. And then he turned and climbed back onto the mud bank, his one eye again locking into the eyes of the old man.
"You like it, huh, little George?" the man chuckled. "Next time I will bring you a swamp rabbit. I will see you again in a few days."
The alligator continued to watch as the old man turned the dugout and started retracing his way across the pond and into the swamp. Charlie Jumper was a Mississippi Seminole, 86 years of age, living in the Big Cypress Swamp, the northern entrance to the Florida Everglades. His wiry body stretched to only 5'9", and his skin, baked deep brown by the many years of the Florida sun, resembled the bark of the cypress tree. His once black hair was now flecked with white. Charlie Jumper lived for the past 60 years at the same spot on the bank of Gopher Creek. He could remember once living in a glade deeper in the swamp, and he remembered an earlier life on a hummock in the River of Grass. But before that, he was not certain. He could not say for sure where he was born, but he knew he was a youth in early manhood when the century turned, and he could be older than the 86 years he claimed. The old Indian now lived alone with his wife, Lily Tiger. But 1 mile away was the home of his youngest son, Billy Joe, and Billy Joe's family. 22 years ago, Billy Joe had gone to the real estate agent in Immokalee and asked if he could buy some of the land and put it to use. He had been told that the land was not for sale, but that he could rent what he wished, and he had signed a rental agreement for 10 acres at a cost of $10 per acre per year. 2 acres of the land he had cleared for a truck farm, and on the rest he raised hogs and a few cows. When Billy Joe had built the wooden frame house 1 mile away, his father had refused to come and live in the house. Billy Joe asked Charlie several times, but he finally accepted the fact that his father would never abandon the camp on the bank of Gopher Creek. Billy Joe had married Watsy Cypress during a celebration of the Green Corn Dance, and now they had 2 children, Lucy, 19, and Timmy, 12. Billy Joe was 42, and Watsy 5 years younger. 3 other sons had been born to Charlie and Lily Jumper. One was buried on a hummock in the marsh. The other 2 had once gone to Oklahoma to attend an Indian trade school and had never returned. In refusing to abandon the old ways, Charlie Jumper was not unique. There were many other Seminole chickies or huts on scattered hummocks throughout the Everglades and in remote sections of Big Cypress. The needs of these people were simple, and their lives were tied to the animals and the water and the land. They had no desire to live elsewhere. Charlie Jumper himself had no thought of leaving his chickies on the bank of Gopher Creek, for to him, the swamp was eternal and indestructible. When Charlie reached his camp, he pulled the dugout onto the bank and began cleaning a black bass he had speared on the way home. Lily was at her sewing machine on a small raised platform in the cooking chickie. The Jumper camp was composed of a cluster of 3 chickies, one for sleeping, one for cooking and eating, and one for storage. Frames for the chickies were dwarf cypress poles, and the pointed roofs were made of palmetto fronds. The sleeping chickie had a raised cypress plank platform 3 feet off the ground, as did the storage one. The floor of the cooking chickie was dirt, except for the small raised platform at the north end that served as Lily's sewing area. The storage chickie had 3 palmetto frond walls, and the other 2 chickies were open on all sides. In the center of the cooking chickie, there was a large iron grate held up by 2 walls of limestone rock, and on the grate sat 2 skillets and a cast-iron Dutch oven. Under the inside eaves of the structure, Charlie had constructed shelves, which held the various pots and pans, such staples as coffee, sugar, salt, flour, and cornmeal, and the few canned goods that were purchased at the store in Copeland. The chickies were built beneath a huge live oak, and the clearing was ringed by magnolia, dwarf cypress, cabbage palms, and wax myrtle. There was a clump of banana trees that Charlie had planted, and a small plot of ground was used for growing corn, tomatoes, beans, squash, sweet and Irish potatoes, and cucumbers. A flock of chickens roamed the clearing, and off to one side there was a hog pen, which was no longer used. All of Lily's time, when not cooking, was spent at the foot-pedal sewing machine, which had been given to her 50 years ago by a white woman who had opened an Indian mission in Everglades City. Lily made colorful Seminole jackets, skirts, and blouses, which Billy Joe sold for her to the souvenir stands along the Tamiami Trail. Her pieces always brought a good price, for she was one of the few Seminole women left who could hand-weave into the cloth the exact designs on the backs of the now almost extinct tree snails. Lily would spend at least 6 hours each day on the sewing platform, and her work produced almost all of the cash money available for purchases of staples and cloth. Most of Charlie's time was spent roaming the swamp and marsh, in search of fish, turtles, squirrels, rabbits, turkey, and ducks. It was seldom any more that he hunted the swift deer or the bear. He also gathered the guavas, blueberries, wild grapes, plums, blackberries, and wild orange, and tended the vegetables he grew in the garden plot. Although Charlie had abandoned the old mode of dress in favor of dungarees, Lily had not. Her thin body was covered to the ankles by the colorful long dress, and a multicolored cape was always draped around her shoulders. Her hair was balled on top of her head and held fast by a hairnet, and the silver eardrops came down to meet a dozen strands of glass beads that she wore around her neck. She was extremely shy and quiet, and would not speak to a stranger even in reply to a question. It was seldom that she said more than a few necessary words, even to her husband or son, and it was only the grandson Timmy who could make her laugh. Charlie was joined in his fish-cleaning chore by a large raccoon that jumped onto his shoulder and started clawing his head frantically.
"You stop that now, Gumbo," he said. "Don't I always give you a piece of the fish? Can't you have patience? You will get your share."
He had kept the coon as a pet for many years, and it had the free run of the chickies. It often took its meals at the same table with them, sometimes eating from Charlie's bowl. A hunter had shot the animal's mother and left it lying on the ground where it had fallen. And Charlie had named the small one Gumbo because he had found it on the limb of a gumbo limbo tree. The coon kept scratching at Charlie's head until he handed it a strip of fish, which it turned over and over in its paws before it began to eat. The old couple did not have any set meal times and ate only when hungry. There was always food cooking on the grate, and now the smell of the turtle stew made Charlie's nose twitch. He came over to the cooking chickie, put the cleaned bass in a pan, and dished himself up a bowl of the stew. Just as he started eating, he heard the rattle of a vehicle coming down the gravel road. An old 1960 Ford pickup turned down the narrow trail leading to the clearing and stopped. Billy Joe Jumper got out of the truck and came over to the chickie, closely followed by Timmy.
"Hello, Papa," Billy Joe said, taking a seat on one of the cabbage palm stumps used as chairs.
"Want to eat?" Charlie asked. "We have a fresh turtle stew."
"No thanks, Papa, I'm not hungry."
"Will you take me fishing, Grandpapa?" Timmy asked quickly.
He always got excited when he came to the camp of his grandfather, for he loved to go into the swamp with the old man in the dugout canoe.
"It is up to your father," Charlie answered. "You must ask him first."
"I guess he can stay," Billy Joe said. "I've got to carry the rent money up to Immokalee. I came by to see if you need anything from the store."
"I need a bolt of the blue cloth and 3 spools of red thread," Lily said. "I have the money here."
She got up from the sewing machine and took a tin can from the overhead shelf and handed a roll of bills to Billy Joe.
"Is that all you need?" he asked.
"We need a can of coffee and a sack of the plain flour," she said. "And I have one finished jacket you can sell."
"It won't bring as good a price in Immokalee as it would in Naples or down on the trail.
Keep it here, and I will sell it for you later this week." Billy Joe got up to leave. Then he turned to Timmy and said,
"You mind your grandfather, you hear? And don't pester your grandmother. And don't pull Gumbo's tail. I will come back for you this afternoon."
Billy Joe turned the pickup west on the narrow limestone road that led from the swamp to Turner River Grade, a gravel road that ran north through the Copeland Prairie to Alligator Alley, the Everglades Parkway toll highway. Instead of turning north when he reached the grade, he turned west again on the state road to Copeland, where he would sell a hamper of tomatoes to the Jane store. He did not want to take the tomatoes all the way to Immokalee because the intense heat would make them soft, and the price would not then be as good. When he reached the store in Copeland, which was on Highway 29, 3 miles north of the Tamiami Trail, he sold the tomatoes and purchased the things his mother wanted. Just above Miles City, the highway intersected Alligator Alley, and he stopped for a few minutes and watched the stream of speeding cars heading east and west across the 2-lane toll road that connected Naples with Fort Lauderdale. The hot May sun was causing heat waves to rise from the asphalt, and because of the long drought, there was little water in the drainage ditch that paralleled the highway. There had been no rain for almost 8 months, and the fields and pastures were burned a deep brown. Even the fronds from the cabbage palms that bordered the highway seemed to be smoking. When he reached Immokalee, he went to the small concrete block building that housed the office of Ryle's Real Estate Agency. At the front desk, he gave the rent money to a secretary, and while she was writing his receipt, Kenneth Ryles came in. He was a young man of 29 who had inherited the real estate business when his father died 5 years ago.
"How are things with you, Billy Joe?"
Ryles asked, handing a sheaf of papers to the secretary. "Drought is beginning to hurt bad," Billy Joe said.
"Yes, it's sure bad. We really need some rain. And by the way, Billy Joe, I just received a notice that 10,000 acres of the land that belongs to the Potter Estate in Miami has been sold. That section includes the land where you live. I wouldn't think that the rent price would change, but if it does, I'll let you know. Until we learn more about the plans of the new owner, just keep making the rent payments here the same as usual."
"I will, Mr. Ryles. And if the rent goes up, I'd appreciate your letting me know right away." Billy Joe then drove to the office of the Everglades Gazette, which was owned by Albert Likes. Likes was also an attorney, although he practiced little law anymore. He was in his late 50s and devoted most of his time to the small weekly newspaper. When Billy Joe had purchased the pickup truck from a used car lot in Naples, he had been overcharged $200 on the finance charges. When Likes learned of this, he had recovered Billy Joe's money and then refused to accept a fee for doing so. Likes was known as a lawyer who would handle legal matters for the Seminoles at no cost, and he counted most of them in the area as his friends. Billy Joe always brought him something when he came to Immokalee. Albert Likes was sitting at a desk in his small cluttered office when Billy Joe entered. He did not look up from his work quickly, for in the jeans, faded blue denim shirt, boots, and cowboy hat, Billy Joe resembled any of dozens of other men to be seen on the streets and in the businesses of this cattle center. When he finally recognized who had entered, he pushed the papers away and said cheerfully,
"Well, hello, Billy Joe. Have a seat. How are things with you?"
"I brought you some beans and some okra," Billy Joe said, handing Likes a brown paper bag. "It's not much, though. The drought has about ruined my whole vegetable crop."
"Yes, we're really beginning to hurt everywhere. The fires have already burned thousands of acres in the southern glades, and some of the fires have burned down so deep into the muck that they say it will take years for them to burn out, even after we get rain. What we need is a pure flood."
"I sure hope the fire doesn't break out in the swamp. I don't see how it could ever be stopped there." Billy Joe pulled up a chair and sat down and said, "Mr. Likes, they just told me down at the real estate office that 10,000 acres of land out there where I live have been sold. Why would anybody buy that much land so far out in the swamp? Most of the cypress has already been cut a long time ago."
"Who told you that?"
Likes asked quickly.
"Mr. Ryles. He said he didn't know if the rent would change or not, but he'd let me know as soon as he heard something. I sure hope it doesn't go up. After this drought killing my crop, I'd have a real hard time getting up more money."
"I don't know why anyone would want that land, Billy Joe, unless they're just speculating. It's an awfully isolated place. If I can find out anything, I'll let you know."
"I would sure appreciate it, Mr. Likes. And if you come see us, we'll take you fishing."
"Thanks for the vegetables," Likes said. "And any time you're in town, come by to see me."
As Billy Joe turned back down Highway 29 towards home, he was troubled by the news of the sale of the land. He just didn't understand why anyone would want to buy it. As soon as his father had left, Timmy dipped a bowl into the turtle stew and began to eat ravenously, although for breakfast that morning he had eaten hot biscuits, corn grits, and fried ham. His mother could not cook the wild game and the turtle as well as his grandmother, and he often slipped off and came down to the Chickies to eat an extra meal. His grandmother made the cornbread in a 5-inch deep loaf, and he broke off a chunk of the steaming hot pone and dipped it into the juice of the stew. The turtle meat was sweet and tender, and he licked his fingers after each bite. Charlie watched in silence for a few minutes, then he said, "You eat like a hungry panther. It is good for you. Make you grow big and strong." Timmy had the same Seminole features as his father and his grandmother: the high cheekbones, the deep brown color, the slightly slanted, piercing eyes. But unlike his grandfather, his eyes were searching and excited, rather than tired and squinting. He finished the bowl of stew and said, "Are we going into the swamp now, Grandpapa?" "I have not finished my food. If you are in such a hurry, you go and dig the worms for the bait." Timmy jumped up and ran to the storage chickie, took out a shovel, and headed for the area of the abandoned hog pen. He came back shortly with a can filled with worms and put them, along with two cane poles, into the dugout. The poles were equipped with lines the same length as the poles, turkey quills, and small hooks. Charlie used them only when fishing with Timmy for the bream, for when he hunted the black bass and the garfish, he used the spear. As they started down Gopher Creek, Timmy sat in the front of the dugout and watched his grandfather move them swiftly across the water. He studied each stroke of the pole in his grandfather's hands. He had always been fascinated by each task Charlie performed, even the seemingly simple things like removing the shell from a turtle, or cleaning a fish, or carving a bowl from a block of cypress. He had a deep love for his grandfather and hoped that someday he could be like him. He finally broke the silence and said, "Where are we going, Grandpapa?"
"We will fish for the bream in the otter pond."
"Will you take me to the big tree?"
"We will go to the tree first, and fish on the way back."
They moved quickly along a narrow winding stream, bordered on both sides by growths of oak and willow and dwarf cypress and wax myrtle, laced overhead by a dozen varieties of vines. The landscape then changed suddenly, and they were in the open area of the dwarf cypress swamp, where Charlie had turned right that morning on his way to the giant alligator. This time they went straight ahead, and on the far side of the clearing they found a stream that led back into a dense area of swamp. After another mile, this stream widened out and spread its black water across the entire land. And rising up before them, towering 150 feet into the sky, was a giant bald cypress that had escaped the saw when the loggers had ravaged the swamp several decades before. Charlie pulled the dugout close to the base of the tree, and when Timmy looked up, it seemed to him that the trunk went out of sight into the clouds. Around the base of the tree, which must be at least 50 feet in circumference, the cypress knees grew so thick that the canoe could not pass through them. Timmy said excitedly,
"Can I climb it, Grandpapa? Please let me climb it this time. You promised you would let me do it someday."
Years ago, Charlie had built a ladder up the side of the tree, driving the rungs in one at a time with nails, moving slowly upward and driving in the cypress rungs until he had no more, then climbing down to the canoe and going back up with more rungs and more nails, moving steadily upward until finally he had reached the top, where the limbs forked outward and upward in graceful curves.
From the top he could see above all the other trees, across the roof of the swamp, past the point where the trees suddenly stopped and the great sea of sawgrass began,
over the river of grass dotted with thick growths of the hummocks, as far away to the horizon as the eye could see. He thought for a moment and said to Timmy, "Not this time. You will climb it, but this is not the time. You must be strong, or your arms would give way before you reach the top."
"Can you see Forever Island from up there?" Timmy asked.
"No, you cannot see Forever Island. You can see the way, but it is too far. It is many miles to the south."
"You will let me climb it some day, won't you, Grandpapa?"
"Yes, I promise you. You will climb the tree." Timmy sat back down in the bottom of the dugout, and the old man pulled them off in a westward direction. He left this swamp by a different stream, and soon came to a pond dotted with dwarf cypress and pickerel weed. He stopped close to a clump of weeds and said, "We will try here for bream, but you must be very quiet. The bream will run away if they hear a sound." Timmy put a worm on the hook, adjusted the turkey quill to a depth of 2 feet, and then threw it out close to the weeds. As soon as the hook had sunk, the quill darted downward and the line became taut. Timmy pulled a fat bream and dropped it into the dugout. Each time a hook hit the water, the same thing happened, and soon they had boated more than a dozen fish. Charlie wrapped his line back around the pole, dropped it into the bottom of the dugout, and said, "We will quit now. You have all the fish you can eat." As Timmy wrapped his line around the pole, Charlie watched a heron picking at minnows along the edge of the water. The flat was also being worked by wood ibis and water turkey. He pointed to a nearby mud bank and said, "You see the marks there? It is where the otter slides down into the water to play. They have been watching us catch their fish. Would you like to see them?" Timmy finished wrapping the line and put it down.
"Yes, Grandpapa, maybe we can catch one and I can carry it home with me."
"You will not catch the otter with your hands. He is too fast. Only the alligator can catch the otter, and he cannot do it unless the otter's mind is elsewhere." Charlie picked up one of the fish and threw it to the edge of the water. Almost instantly, a brown otter shot down the mud bank, grabbed the fish in its mouth, stared intensely at the man and boy, then scurried back up the bank. The otter paused for a moment more, again staring at the intruders. Then he scurried out of sight into the brush. "Sometimes they will come out and play for you," Charlie said. "They have even come into the chickies. If we stayed here longer, they would not be afraid. But we must go now. We have fish to clean for your supper." Timmy lay on his back and looked upward into the trees and the sky as his father pulled the dugout toward home. It made him dizzy to watch the limbs and the vines and the clouds fly by overhead and hear the rippling of the water as the ancient canoe sliced through the swamp. High up in the sky, he could see a flight of white ibis winging its way south toward the marsh country, and although he could not see it, he listened to the deep-throated croak of a great blue heron. He draped one leg over the side of the dugout and let the water swirl across his bare foot. In a moment, he was asleep, and he was awakened only when he became aware that the movement of the dugout had stopped. When Timmy pushed himself up, he did not see his grandfather. For a moment, he was startled. Then he looked up a shallow slough and saw Charlie snatching something from the bottom and putting it into his pocket. He soon returned to the canoe and said, "Crawfish. They are for Gumbo. These are for him like candy is for you. He could eat a gallon if you would give it to him." When they started to leave, Charlie suddenly stopped the dugout again and walked back up the slough. He noticed a fresh gash cut into the side of a tree. Then he waded further up the slough. As far as he could see into the swamp, there was a line of fresh gashes cut into trees. He wondered about this for a moment. Then he turned and retraced his path back to Timmy. As soon as the bow of the dugout reached land at the chickies, the coon jumped in and smelled the fish. Then he climbed to Charlie's shoulder and started scratching his head.
Charlie put him out of the dugout. "These fish are not for you, Gumbo," he said. "They are for—"
Sample complete. Ready to continue?